The book club is brought to you in association with the Charles Stanley community, providing our clients, colleagues, and friends with practical support and conversation. Find out more at Charles Stanley Community.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Books Podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined by Chris Gosden, who is the Professor of European Archaeology at the University of Oxford and the author of a new book which covers a huge area of history and a huge area of geography, and which tells us the story of the history of magic, from alchemy to witchcraft, from the Ice Age to the present. Chris, welcome. Now, this is a huge book. It's a huge kind of subject. Can you start, because you do start in the book, by saying, you know, what you mean by magic? Because obviously we're not talking Paul Daniels and the Great Suprendo here, are we?
Unfortunately not, in some ways. I'm a great fan of all that sort of stuff. No, we're talking about slightly more metaphysical magic, I would say. So my definition of magic is it's to do with the human participation in the universe, so that we feel, if we're in a magical mindset, that we can affect the universe in various different ways through speaking, through acting, through doing a whole range of things which wouldn't necessarily be allowed for in a scientific paradigm. But equally, the universe can affect us through the movements of planets, through a whole range of the actions of spirits, a whole range of things. So it posits a sort of radical two-way movement between us and the universe as a whole.
Is it different in character from, obviously we affect the universe when we design things, when we affect machines, when we, you know, I mean, we shape the world around us in a non-magical way, as we'd see it. And equally, that idea of man's participation and interchange with cosmic forces is something that seems to be at the basis of religion. Now, you do draw a distinction between magic, science, and religion, and you talk about them being in a relationship. Can you explain a bit how you kind of connect them?
No, absolutely. I've used an image of a triple helix, so a bit like the genetic double helix. There are three strands of human history which are interconnected but somewhat separate, and those three strands are the ones that you've mentioned: magic, religion, and science. So one could talk for ages about how you define these things, but my brief definition is that religion is a belief in a many gods or a single god, and we interact with the world, with the cosmos, through the gods or a god. And science asks us to stand back from the world, to take a slightly more objective view, to think about the forces of the world in terms of mathematics, in terms of broad and basic principles. So that, as you say, people attempt to transform the world in all sorts of ways, but these are distinct but linked. And I definitely don't think that one is better than the other. And this is not a book against religion, against science. I mean, it would be ridiculous. So I think they, within the human spirit, as it were, there's a desire to belong, to connect. There's often a desire to feel the transcendent, which we might give the name of God to. And there is a desire, in a much more practical way, to understand and influence the world. And those three desires we can talk about in terms of magic, religion, and science. Combination of the three, really.
Is it a book that's pro-magic, if you say it's not anti-religion or anti-science?
Yeah, no, it is, definitely. Mainly because so many histories of religion and science have been written, and we would all accept that those things are central to our culture today, whereas magic has been marginalised, partly through a fairly successful propaganda campaign on the part of religion and science. So no, I'm trying to reintroduce magic as a crucial strand in human history, but also maybe a crucial strand in our future as well.
Well, that sounds, I mean, that's quite a surprising thing to hear from, you know, someone whose approach as an academic might be expected to be more anthropological, if you like. or archaeological in your case.
Yeah, yeah. My day job is digging things up. But, I mean, the purpose of archaeology is to think about what it means to be human, generally speaking, often in the long durée, the longest span of human history. So my argument would be that a vital part of being human is a belief and practice of magic, and that has dropped out.
Where does it begin? I mean, not for you, though you could maybe talk about that, but you're an archaeologist, you deal with very, very old things, and
yeah,
you know, there are a few things older than the things you describe in the beginning of your book.
Yeah.
Does it precede religion and precede science? Is it the kind of substrate on which everything else is built?
Yes, I think it both does and doesn't. So I think those three desires, the desire to participate, to see transcendence, and to understand the world in a more practical sense, are always there, but they get formalized in various different ways at different periods. So maybe magic gets slightly more formalized early on, and religion, I don't know, over the last 10,000 years or so, and science is, you know, depending on how you date these things, is a product of the ancient Greek world or the more modern, the last few centuries. So I would see magic as earliest, but I think all three have existed all the time.
And what are some of the earliest things that tell us that magic was being practiced? Because you go right back to the Paleolithic, don't you?
I do. So one of the earliest examples I use in the book is of a beautiful little ivory figure. It's made of mammoth ivory. And it's not ivory as we in elephant ivory, and it's in the form of some sort of slightly ambiguous figure. It's mainly got the body of a human, but has definitely got the head of something like a lion. And it's very hard to know in these periods of the distant past what people were thinking and doing. But one possibility is through creating a sort of tri-element figure. It has a bit of mammoth in it, it has a bit of lion in it, it has a bit of human, that possibly the makers and users of this thing were trying to combine the capabilities, the strengths in terms of those two creatures into the one object. And this thing's 40,000 years old. It was found in a cave, in Städel Cave in Germany. So you know, I'm not claiming that that's the first bit of magic. That's just where I happen to start the book. But I think it does go way back.
I mean, that's one of the things that seems to emerge all over the world, this idea of combining human and animal or natural world's properties. I mean, you have an extraordinary kind of series of excavations where you describe how people were buried separately from their heads, and sometimes the sort of gazelle heads were buried on the people's bodies. And so there was a kind of swapping around that went on. Is that one of the kind of commonalities? Because you do go all over the world and all over history, and I'm wondering what sort of threads come through that seem to be common magical practices.
Yes, yes, some sort of playing with form, species, substance, I would say. I mean, we often, in looking at the past, we have to realise that we're in a slightly unusual historical relationship. So we've become very Linnaean, for instance. We divide up different species, and then we have, you know, disciplines of physics, chemistry, and biology, and the first two look at what are often seen to be the inanimate world, whereas biology looks at the living world. But most people in most times and places don't operate to those categories. What we think of the distinction between human and animal isn't always there. So yes, people are buried 14,000 years ago in the Levant. You get a human body with a gazelle head. Now that's quite hard for us to, you know, grasp, but it seems to be an act of reverence rather than something that was trying to subvert the order. So we believe in that particular instance, people and gazelles were merged inside, and maybe, you know, not as distinct as we would take them to be.
You talk about the way in which ritual might be something that's been sort of under-described as a way of describing how human settlements and civilizations sort of changed. I mean, you say, you know, well, there's the, you know, one of the big things that people have made historically is this idea there's a moment or a period when we shift from hunter-gathering to agriculture. And you try and complicate that a little, don't you?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, we've got to be careful with the word ritual. It's often said if archaeologists can't explain something, they give it the label of ritual. But I think there is a sort of serious purpose. I think we're obviously practical creatures. We need to provide ourselves with food, shelter, protection from various different things. But I think also we're always metaphysical. We wonder how the world works, what our relationship with various other sorts of things are. And rather than necessarily seeing human history as a process of getting greater practical control over the world, so that's the model where people started off as hunters and gatherers, lived on wild plants and animals, and then learned how to domesticate, how to look after, and farming is often seen as greater control of the world. I think rather than seeing it like that, then we should see these things as a metaphysical shift, that people had very close relationships with gazelles and those sorts of things when they were hunters and gatherers, and then equally close but slightly different relationships with sheep and goats and domesticated species later on. But in all times and places, people worry about their position, wonder about their position, and what the capabilities of various different things are, what the capabilities of humans are. And I don't, you know, we haven't stopped doing that today. We can explain a certain range of things, but we're puzzled about a heck of a lot of the universe.
You talk a little also about the difficulty of knowing exactly what was going on, you know, before we have a written record. When does magic start to be, as it were, written down? I mean, again, that seems to be a longer time ago than I'd have thought.
Yes, I mean, more or less with the first writing, which is in Mesopotamia about 5,500 years ago, maybe slightly later than that. And almost immediately we get accounts of various magical practices in ancient Mesopotamia. There are these group of people called Ashipu, who are sometimes translated as exorcists, but more often as magicians. And they can cure the sick. They make observations of the sun, moon, and the stars. And so some of the earliest cuneiform records, and these are people writing on wet clay with little styluses creating cuneiform texts, then some of those things are, you know, what do we have in the king's palace? But equally, there are things about the activities of the Ashipu and training texts that you need to train to become an Ashipu. And the Egyptians are much, you know, if anyone anywhere has been metaphysical, it's been the ancient Egyptians. And so their earliest hieroglyphic writing often contains wondering about gods and the nature of the cosmos. So yeah, I mean, magic goes back as far as written records of magic goes back as far as there is writing.
And to go back to the ancient Babylonians, what was in a day's work for an Ashipu?
There's a lovely account of how to cure someone if they've been possessed by a demon, and the person who is possessed has ringing in their ears, what we probably call tinnitus, as a result of that. And the Ashipu does a whole range of different things. There's a whole series of practical. They sweep their courtyard. They go and get various herbs from the steppe, and they talk to the person. They ask them about issues in their life. So that we might see as a form of counselling, although they almost certainly didn't. But the end aim of this sequence of events was to try and get the demon to marry another being. So the Ashipu would make an effigy of the demon and do something like tie it to a tree at the effigy. And if it worked, then the demon would marry the tree, and the person who had possessed them, their ears stopped ringing. So, I mean, there's a combination in there of things that we would see as sort of medical, psychoanalytic, you know, counselling, but then also things to do with getting demons to marry trees, which we can't recognise very easily within our notions of how the world works.
I mean, that points to something that seems to be implicit in the book. And I mean, I think has been argued elsewhere that magical ritual, as not very distinct from medicine, as not very distinct from the science of the world, or they wouldn't have thought of them as distinct, nevertheless kind of pushed advances in medicine and in science. I mean, a large part of the book talks about, you know, all over the world, the way in which the movements of the heavens, you know, for magical reasons, we started to need mathematics and need astronomy.
Yeah, this is one definite area where magic and science are historically linked. And the two areas that you've talked about are vital. One is medicine, so the sorts of medical practices of the Ashipu, which to our view are wrapped up in a whole series of other things. But there was a thing called the King's Watch, for instance, later on in Babylon, where for hundreds of years, people would make very detailed observations of the movement of the sun, moon, and the stars, and for astrological purposes. But of course, these were incredibly important astronomically, and also they pushed on the development of mathematics. So both astronomy and mathematics are linked into astrology. And the third area that people have talked of, which is very important, is the relationship between alchemy and chemistry. So people attempting to turn base metals into gold, lead into gold, those sorts of things, gave rise, without really meaning to or thinking about it, to a whole series of laboratory procedures which became the basis of chemistry, but also a whole series of understandings of the chemical properties of, you know, first of all metals, but then a whole range of other things as well. So the history of science and the history of magic are you know, often one and the same thing.
You have a section, I mean, this jumps forward a bit, but where you talk about, you know, Newton, one of the great fathers of science, and of course, you know, the one fun fact everyone knows about Newton is that he was also an alchemist. Yeah. You say that his not quite contemporary John Dee, you know, who we know was apocryphally at least, you know, a loon who was trying to talk to angels. Dee has got a rather worse press than he deserves.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, he had a rather more chaotic life than Newton. So there is chaos in Dee's life. But yes, he was an astrologer. He did, through his rather dodgy assistant Kelly, he did try and talk. Well, he in his own view, he succeeded in talking to angels. And briefly, he was employed by Elizabeth I as a sort of court magician, and he decided that the time of her coronation, based on astrological movements. He was also used as a sort of weapon of war to think in magical terms how she might, you know, counteract various of her enemies. So all that side of Dee we see as slightly dubious and uncertain. But interestingly, he came up with a theory which sort of prefigured a theory of gravity. So he was interested in astrology and therefore interested in how the sun, moon, and stars affected us. So he was looking for a force that could be exerted between them and us, and some sort of astrological force. And, you know, that wasn't all that far off a notion of the solar system, the universe, not that they necessarily thought in these terms then, you know, being moved by the force of gravity. So when Newton comes along in the later 17th and early 18th century and does formalize a theory of gravity, you know, there are echoes of Dee in his work.
Yes, is that sense of looking for the occult, which now has all sorts of kind of Hammer horror overtones, it wouldn't have been a sort of Hammer horror thing to them. It was sort of looking for just hidden forces. Is that right?
Yes, yes. I do dislike the term occult, I must say, because it implies that so much of magic was a sort of hole in the corner, you know, furtive activity. And some of it, of course, was. But a lot of these things, you know, Dee was very open about what he did. Astrologers practiced across Britain and Europe in an absolutely open manner. So the writing up of magic over the last couple of hundred years or so does tend to emphasize things like the occult, but I think that's, you know, that's relatively rare that people were operating with hidden knowledge, hidden practices.
Is there a way of sort of historicizing the way magic is seen in any given era, because it feels like so much of it, through so much history, you know, there's a lot of ancestor worship in the earliest forms of magic that you describe all over the world. And there's, you know, for instance, you know, Dee and his contemporaries would have looked back, as you write, to Hermes Trismegistus.
Mm.
And, you know, ancient Egypt, for some reason, their magical tradition became very important in the West.
Yeah.
Why was that, and how is it that these lines of inheritance kind of emerge?
Yes, that's a very good and very large question. So a general answer to start with is that just as religion and science are historically and culturally based, they don't exist in some sort of vacuum, then so does magic. So although I've tried a sort of general definition of magic, I almost immediately say that it is nuanced by place, time, people's understanding of the world. I think for me, and I'm absolutely not a specialist in this, I'm just someone who really likes it, that the period of the Renaissance is extremely interesting because you get this huge melange of forces, some of which come out of medieval Europe, but some of which come out of the rediscovery of ancient Greece and Rome. And through them, Hermes Trismegistus didn't exist, but was thought to be possibly an Egyptian. But that false knowledge, as it were, was handed down by the Greeks. So into this rich mix of forces in the Renaissance, you get a very important strand of the ancient world, which we usually think of in terms of, you know, the more rational side of things, the rational elements of Greek philosophy, but at least as important were harking back to older traditions of alchemy and those sorts of things that Hermes Trismegistus was connected to.
Are there sort of distinct magical traditions? I mean, you've talked a lot here about that kind of Western, Near Eastern set of mixed influences. But you also talk about Australia, you talk about China.
Yeah.
Are these totally different magical worldviews, or are there things that you can see that are in common?
A bit of both, I would say. I mean, at base, they're totally different. I think China, again, is fascinating because a lot of Chinese practices generally, but the practice of magic, revolved around a relationship with the ancestors. So people felt that their well-being in the present was often dependent on the actions of their ancestors in the afterlife, and therefore they had to keep the ancestors sweet by giving feasts for them, doing a whole range of you know, respectful practices, but also they would ask there's a tradition of divination which comes out of the Bronze Age in China, where people are asking their ancestors questions, and they have very specific technologies for doing that. They have either the undershell of a turtle or the shoulder blade of an ox, and they would write a question on one of these two things, which could only have a yes or no answer. Will the queen have a boy? Will our harvest fail? And then they would apply the ancient equivalent of a red hot poker to the shell or the bone, and then watch it crack. And the crack was the voice of the ancestor in the sound, and the shape of the crack gave you the yes or no response. And this is, I mean, divination happens all over the place, but this very specific tradition evolves within China and very specifically to do with the importance of the ancestors. And Australia is very different again. And Europeans, I think, only ever have a very superficial understanding of Aboriginal culture, which is always much more deep and sophisticated than we understand. But my superficial understanding would be that many Aboriginal people would not see that they have a relationship with the land on which they live, but they are in some way, they are the land, and the land forms their culture. So the the songs, the stories, the genealogies are given to them by the landscape in which they live. And therefore, people are able to sing the structure of the landscape, for instance. The rhythm of the song echoes or evokes the topographic shape of the landscape. And again, those traditions are so interesting, but so very different to our own, that, you know, they give us quite a lot of pause for thought.
One of the things that surprised me, you talk a little in the book about shamans, who seem to be kind of quite a controversial subject among archaeologists. I sort of thought of shamans as being from the Americas, and you're locating them in the Arctic tundra more often. Are those two different sorts of shaman I'm thinking of?
They're different but related. So the shamans of Eurasia today, and probably for the last quite a few thousand years, are located in Siberia. And these are people who will have the power to intercede with the spirit world. They can either travel to the spirit world, or they can inhabit important animals like bears or reindeer or whatever. They can become a bear for a while and then come back unharmed. The Americas were peopled for the first time, probably one of the last bits of the globe to get human beings, peopled for the first time about 15,000 years ago. And those people came from Siberia. So they walked across
the Bering Strait.
Across the Bering Strait, yeah. There was land all the way across. So those American shamanistic traditions have their ancestry in Siberia. So they are both the, you know, linked, but also then they go off in their own different trajectories and directions.
What was the point at which, at least in the West, though I'm sure it's happened elsewhere in the world as well, we sort of turned on magic?
That again is a good and big question. I think notions of heresy were obviously, religious notions of heresy were obviously extremely important coming out of the later Middle Ages into the early modern period. So not only did you have to have the right strands of religious belief, but then other structures of belief like magic could get you into, well, deadly trouble. But then I think post-Newton, and, you know, again, a huge topic and one that I'm by no means a specialist in, science came to think of itself, in the figure of Newton, I don't think this was true, but sometime afterwards, science came to think of itself as a royal road to truth, that to really understand the world, the only way of doing that was through scientific means. And therefore, things like magic were seen as second-rate, primitive, dangerous, you know, and ultimately ineffective. So science's question of magic would be, does it work? And where, you know, the notion of working is judged in a very sort of practical, empirical sense.
And to be the scientific kind of pauperite here. You know, people might still say, you're advocating, you're saying magic has a place in our world. We should start to, you know, magic has a place in our future. I think you close the book by saying, you know, I think magic is something we can learn from. But some people would say, well, only in as much as it works or offers an explanatory adequacy for its way of, you know, accounting for phenomena. I mean, isn't that quite a strong argument?
Yes and no, I think. If that argument is phrased purely in terms of a sort of experimental, empirical way of thinking about the world, then I think that is trying to get magic to perform in a way that it can't. So to go back to the Ashipu, let's presume that they cured the patient of their tinnitus. So we might see the cure in the herbs that they gave them, which would allow for a medical explanation. But I think also recent forms of medicine in the present would say that people's psychological states are important in terms of their health and well-being, whether they recover from something or not. And maybe You know, it's not just, certainly the Ashipu wouldn't have thought it was only the herds or even mainly the herds. Maybe the more psychological stuff. And that psychological stuff may have included strapping an effigy of the demon to a tree. And then, you know, the person breathed a sigh of relief, relaxed, and the tinnitus gradually went away. So I think, you know, if you analyse the actions of the Ashipu by taking their herbs and saying, well, you know, that wouldn't work on the basis of what we know in terms of modern medicine, then, you know, fair enough. But it's part of a much broader package, which in fact deals with a much more rounded notion of what it means to be human. So our psychological states, our feeling of fear about the world, wonder about the world, are incredibly important, but often slightly hard, if not impossible in some elements, to cope with in a scientific worldview.
I guess, you know, a medical doctor might say, well, yes, but we can, you know, if not completely account for, we can measure the placebo effect. You know, we know that, yeah, that, you know, the mind-body divide isn't absolute. We can, you know, that in effect we can fold what are the accidental discoveries of magic into a scientific schema without calling them magic anymore. I mean, the old quote that magic is undiscovered science.
Yeah.
I mean, that surely has some sort of virtue to it as a way of thinking about the world, you know, if you define magic as not science.
Yes, but for me, I mean, science's great strength is it works. You know, so as a friend of mine said, you know, nobody would want to go back to medieval dentistry. there's no doubt. But in terms of say something like an ethics of care, how we relate more broadly to the planet, then science, that is not, you can graft that onto science, but science doesn't give you that. Whereas I think something like magic, through its notion of us participating in the universe, and maybe we are kin to the world in a variety of different ways, and if we're, you know, we care for our kin, we care for our friends, and those sorts of elements of human experience could actually counterbalance science. Because when science is linked strongly, as it is at the moment, to, you know, market economies and capitalism, then it allows us to extract, it allows us to take a great deal from the world. But what magic might be able to do is say, hang on a minute, you can do this, but should you do it? So that's I think is magic's, if you try and think about it purely in terms of its physical efficacy, then it's not going to look good against science. But if it helps you, you know, pose these broader relationships and questions, then I think it's vitally important.
What got you started on this, on thinking, you know, as an archaeologist? Did you keep seeing instances of what appeared to be magical objects, magical evidence of magical rituals or magical places, and think, you know, this is something that my discipline hasn't explored enough?
Yeah, well, I think it's two things broadly. One is I worked for quite a while in Papua New Guinea as an archaeologist digging up the past, and I got to know people relatively well, and I used to go every year for 10 years, and you know, people are, I mean, they're not serious about magic in the sense that they just totally take it for granted, that if you get ill, it may well be as a result of sorcery, that you can't go to a particular place because it's got a dangerous spirit in it. There's a whole range of things that are just part of the fabric of people's lives, and which are being really interestingly repurposed now. So to get your kids into university, you fill in the, you know, the equivalent of the UCAS form, but then you might well want to practice some magic to make sure the application is successful. So
sharp elbowed middle classes.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. give the middle classes a weapon and they will take it wherever they are in the world. So for Papua New Guineans, you know, if you said all this stuff doesn't exist, then I don't think they'd even recognize the set. So that on the one hand, here were a group of people who I knew, liked, respected, and there was no doubt that for them this stuff was real. So that on the one hand, and then also I worked in one of the Oxford University museums, the Pitt Rivers Museum, which is, for anyone who hasn't been there, is a most marvellous museum. And it's got a load of magical stuff in it. So it's got a witch in a bottle, it's got lots of amulets, it's got a whole range of different things, and some of which come from Britain rather than further flung parts of the world. And that got me thinking, you know, there are so many traditions here with things that we would call magical. How and why, and how come we haven't thought more about all this stuff?
Have you, I mean, you're obviously an enthusiast. Have you practiced magic yourself? Is it?
No, I'm not going to answer. No, I haven't. I am a sort of positive agnostic as to whether magic works or not. I think if we, and I run this experiment for myself, I think if we could open ourselves up to a broader view of the world. So many people in the world, for instance, would say that the world is sentient, not just the plants and animals, but the rocks, the rivers, the sun, all of those sorts of things. Now, that seems to me a slightly unlikely possibility. But I mean, I wonder what the world would look like if I could start to believe that. And that would then give you a connection, give you a kinship, give you a depth of relationship. So I think the fact that we've so closed ourselves off from magic, the least we can do at this point in the present, where we're desperate for thinking new thoughts, well, whatever is going on in the world, it's not good.
Wasn't it Henri Bergson who had the idea that consciousness could be a property of the universe and that our minds are just receivers?
Absolutely, absolutely. And serious philosophers are thinking about this as well. So it is a mystery if you posit that some things are conscious and lots of things aren't. So one way out of that impasse is to think that maybe in some way, at some level, everything is conscious. And then you've just got different types, forms, levels of conscious. And I think that's a fabulous idea.
Can I ask to be end on a sort of slightly practical note to go back maybe to our point? The way we think about magic now, there are certain things that are kind of, you know, associated with magic, you know, the magic wand, the magic word, you know, things like abracadabra. Where do they come from? Is a magic wand something that's a sort of creation of, you know, Harry Potter's ancestors, or were there magic wands in real magic, if you like?
Yes, there have been a variety the Egyptians had an object which looks more like a boomerang to us than a quintessential wand. But one translation for what that object is as a wand. And it was definitely a magical object that helped you practice magic in various other traditions. I mean, it would be interesting to think where the sort of, you know, the fictional apparatus of magic has come from. I guess it's come from all sorts of places. But, I mean, things like spells, you know, people did practice spells written or spoken. So I think the sort of the cultural, you know, the popular cultural magic has taken bits and pieces from real life, as it were, and combined them into quite a compelling combination of things.
Where does abracadabra come from?
Well, our earliest written knowledge of abracadabra is in a manuscript of 1362. But people like the Greeks played around with the sounds of words and made up this nonsense words, essentially, which sounded powerful and potentially useful. And abracadabra fits within this sort of broader tradition of words that maybe had efficacy by virtue of their sound.
Do you have a sense? I mean, I imagine this is, to a certain extent, guesswork, but a sense of the way in which magical traditions changed when written language came along?
Yes, I think probably, like so many things, they became formalized, both in the sense of the knowledge that, you know, you could write it down on a cuneiform tablet or in hieroglyphics. But I think probably they also linked into formalization in the sense that people like Ashipu, people who were recognized magicians, were also sort of separated from the broader group of there was a specialist that you could link to magic. And for the Ishipu, who I keep talking about, I mean, a lot of their training was to read and remember magical texts. And this almost certainly happened. I mean, it's said, nobody knows, it's said that the Druids in Britain could remember vast amounts of information, which was not written. So to become a Druid, you had to spend a decade or more learning all this stuff and remembering it and being able to use it in the appropriate manner. So when people were able to write, then you could download a lot of that information and knowledge, and maybe then it became a bit more formalized than it had been, because even the best memory will misremember things over a period of time, which is slightly and not impossible, but harder to do once you've written it all down.
Yeah. In the 20th century, do you think that the magical... There seems to be a sort of campery, the sort of Madame Blavatsky's and the Aleister Crowley's.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of come off looking like frauds, don't they?
Yeah, probably were.
Is there a sort of serious magical tradition still going on, do you think?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, I think the flip side of magic being marginalised by religion and science over the last few centuries is it then became very attractive to anyone who was countercultural. So someone like Aleister Crowley, you know, whatever he wanted, was to subvert the order of polite society and in all its ways. So magic partly appealed to him because it was the inverse of how bourgeois society organized itself or understood the world. But yeah, and I think that has got in the way of thought. So Freud, for instance, was very interested in seances, very interested in telepathy, a whole range. And people have said possibly the notion of the unconscious, something that's beneath our conscious thought, came out of his encounters with things like the spirit world, that there is a world out there which is influencing us, which is incredibly important, but we don't normally have very easy access to. So I think in the 20th century, magic and science, if you think of psychoanalysis as a science, have been linked.
Well, Jung sort of crosses that boundary, doesn't he?
Jung, definitely, yes. All those tarot cards and archetypes and all those sorts of things. And the thing that fascinates me, and this is a long way above my pay grade as a humble archaeologist, are things like quantum mechanics, which I have the barest glimmer of. But there are things posited in quantum mechanics, you know, two particles can be in the same place at the same time, and that possibly the observer influences the things that they're observing. I mean, certainly that latter, your average animist who feels that they're influencing the world and it them would say, yes, of course, we influence the physical world all the time. So I think there are interesting things happening in science at the moment, which actually take us closer to what we've often thought of as magic.
I think also there is one of the pioneering quantum physicists was in analysis with Jung. I think it was Linus Pauling.
Ah, could be. I didn't know that. Yeah, no, that's quite possible.
I'll have to check. Anyway, well, we could go on and on, but unfortunately I have to, you know, put you in a box and saw you in half now. Chris, this was fascinating to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Absolute pleasure. It's been really, really good to talk to you.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, we very much hope that you'll subscribe on your podcast provider of choice and or rate and review us. Well, especially if you liked it. If you hated it, don't feel you have to review it. And equally, if there's something that you wanted to ask us about, something you think we could do better or something you enjoyed, please do send us your feedback to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks again for listening, and please join us for our next episode.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.